So one thing that I think is very interesting about your evolution intellectually, spiritually, culturally, is the shift that you've had from Mormonism to other. But also not, it doesn't seem to me like it's been a very hard break. You are still kind of a Mormon appreciator. And I wonder how did that go? I mean, what was this evolution? Because I have a lot of people on the show that are either religious or are in the process of converting. They see a lot of value in religion. Some struggle with it, like myself. So I wonder how that process was for you. I mean, maybe you could tell me a little bit about, the trajectory that you've taken and what's your current resting point with religion?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really, while it was going on, it was really hard. And then in retrospect, it was really pleasant, is what I'd say. In the sense of I, growing up within Mormonism, I experienced a great deal of tension constantly. In the sense of I really loved the culture. I really loved my family. I really loved the people. I loved a great deal of it. And I really loved a lot of the theology, a great deal. At the same time, I always fancied myself a rationalist type. I always fancied myself a skeptic. And so very early on, I started diving into the hard knowledge-driven questions about the history, about the does all this hold together, everything. And I experienced a lot of tension with that, that I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with. So throughout my life, I kept finding myself leaning up towards the edge of a question and then saying, I don't want anything to do with this. If I keep thinking in this direction, I will go in the wrong direction. And that happened all through my childhood, particularly, I guess, it started when I was 13, 14 or so. You know, when I say all through my childhood, I wasn't an 8-year-old looking around thinking my whole culture is wrong. But very much happened there. I always knew as a Mormon that I would be going on a Mormon mission, and I figured this would be the point for me to really figure it all out. So, unusually for Mormons, usually when people are going on missions, they'll stand up and be like, you know, I know the church is true. I'm so excited to bring this great thing to others, so forth. I stood in front of my childhood congregation and I said, you know, I don't know that the church is true. I hope it's true. I believe it's true. I want it to be true. I know it's good, but I don't know that it's true. And within Mormonism, there's very much this emphasis on getting a personal spiritual answer, on going to God, asking God directly, is this true? And knowing on some spiritual level that it is. And I knew always that I did not have that. And it haunted me that I did not have that. It destroyed me inside that I did not have that. So when I went out on my mission, I would be spending sometimes, some nights, like half an hour, 45 minutes on my knees, begging God, you know, show me something, help me understand that I am not throwing my life away on a falsehood. And those 2 years of my mission, they were incredible in a lot of ways. They were beautiful in a lot of ways. And they were, in other ways, the worst years of my life as I was going through. And a mission, I would say, you're much more alive on a mission than you are in regular life in a lot of ways, in that I wasn't spending all my time interfacing with people through a computer. I wasn't spending all my time on, you know, entertainment, things like that. I was spending almost all of my time engaging with other people in the physical space. You're with a mission companion 24 hours a day, and you're never apart except when you're in the bathroom. You're always looking for random people on the street to talk with. You're just so alive, so animated out there in so many ways. But that also gives you nowhere to hide. So while I was out there, I'm looking around, I'm trying to talk to people about Mormonism, trying to convince people of it, while at the same time digging through and trying to convince myself that all the questions that I had about it were wrong, that I was wrong. So that was really the process I was going through. Is the whole time I was thinking, I have these questions, I have these issues, they are not being resolved, and I have to be wrong. I have to be wrong because this is my culture, because this is my faith, because I love all of this, because this is right, and because everyone I love has always pursued this for generations. My whole family mythos is built around this, my whole cultural mythos is built around this. This has to be true. But it's not fitting, it's not working. And at some point in that, after some really, really unfortunate experiences in it, I would say. I looked around and realized I am never going to fit into this. I am never going to change my mind and start actually, sincerely believing that I believe in this. I'm just trying to convince myself. And I didn't really know what to do with that. I came home from my mission and I knew that I would never be an Orthodox Mormon. But I still thought I could be an orthopraxe one. So when I say Orthodox versus orthopraxe, I mean I knew I could never precisely believe the doctrine as it was supposed to be, but I thought I could make myself live within that frame regardless and make it work, and thought that basically the essence of it was more or less right. And I just spent 2 years adrift, basically. 2 years saying, I can't stay, I can't go, I can't do anything, I'm paralyzed. At the end of that, I looked around and I thought, look, I need to be honest with myself. I need to be honest with my family and with the world about the way I actually think about things and why I actually think about them. I need to let myself actually follow the thoughts that I've initiated towards their natural conclusion, because I hadn't been letting myself follow them towards their conclusion. I hadn't actually thought to myself, the whole structure I am in is built on falsehoods, and made myself believe it. I just thought, what if it is? And so 2 years after my mission, I looked around and I said, I need to figure this out. So I sat down. This is actually the origin of this account name, is I made this account name to go talk to the ex-Mormon subreddit, which had always been this very demonic feeling place to me. Every time I went there, I felt like it was evil, it was nasty, it was horrible. Stay far, far away from this in a very, very visceral way. And so I went there and started chatting with them, and a couple of people there were really thoughtful and were really reasonable and very much belied my perception of ex-Mormons and my experience with ex-Mormons, and made me a lot more confident culturally in realizing, hold on, some other people have actually taken this specific path and stayed people who I can look at and resonate with and intellectually and emotionally respect in a way that felt important to me. And so they sort of acted as a model for me in saying, yeah, I can step away and remain fair and remain polite and remain cordial towards a faith that has meant so much to so many around me and that forms such an important part of my life. And then I can figure things out for myself. And that really freed me up to, up until that point, if you look at my online output, if you look at my writing output up to that point, and it's all under different account names, so no one can, but if one did, they would not find anything like what I am writing today. They would find hints here and there, they would find sketches here and there, but there were so many ways I was subconsciously restraining my thought, so many ways I was preventing myself from going down certain lines of investigation, preventing myself from saying certain things that I really thought about the world that came off when I stepped away from Mormonism, such that I was able to almost on a dime become a much more, I think, a much more compelling and a much more serious thinker and writer. And it was the reason I'm not bitter, it was really painful. I had a month or two of very deep bitterness about it. But the reason I'm not bitter is because it was a very natural evolution for me, because I never had this, I am all into this, and I absolutely know that this is the path of righteousness, to I feel completely betrayed by everything around me. I am striving, I'm figuring things out, I want to figure things out towards this moment of deep sadness and yes, anger and all the negative emotions of I've been raised in a culture that is fundamentally founded on some falsehoods too. But all the beautiful things that I saw and all the things that I was developing within, I wasn't wrong to notice those either, and I am certain a synthesis can be found. So where I'm at spiritually now, look, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in the supernatural as such. What I do believe in is a sort of meta-religious concept of looking at religions as structures that have arisen in to meet the needs and the real or the perceived needs of the cultures in which they arise in that persist if they keep meeting those needs and persist in stable forms if they keep having cause to be stable. And seeing all of life as basically a struggle for growth, creativity, beauty, and the impossible push towards perfection, and against emptiness, decay, lifelessness, and death, which, as I like to say, are the most natural things in the universe. That's the frame I see myself in. And in as much as it interacts with religion favorably, it interacts with religion favorably. In as much as it criticizes religion, there's plenty that I have to criticize it on, but I try to stay reflective about it. That's a long answer, but it's about as short an answer as I can give to properly answer that question.
The difference that you highlight between orthodoxy kind of and orthopraxy, I think is such a kind of a core aspect of a lot of conversations that I've had with people on this podcast. And I think it's just kind of out there in the ether. I've seen a lot of conversions. I've seen, you know, my own conversion in the last few years was kind of based on the idea that, okay, if I just get the orthopraxy right, then the orthodoxy will follow. And then I'm just kind of waiting for, you know, the moment of epiphany. And as I've mentioned before on this podcast, I've been waiting. Yeah. Been waiting for a while now. And maybe, you know, I'm kind of like this little, you know, homunculus with my little toothpaste tube that's been thoroughly wrung out, and I'm kind of trying to shove it back in with a little, you know, spoon, and, you know, being frustrated at the thing. And you know, not much is going back in. That's all. But I'm trying. I'm out there with my little spoon and the toothpaste and the little tube that's been really smushed to death. And we're trying here. But you know, it's you know, like you said, you know, there's a certain element of wandering in the desert. I'm still, you know, I'm still relatively, you know, on board with continuing wandering, because I don't come from a background as religious as you. I mean, my parents were very much cafeteria Catholics. You know, I grew up atheist, not because my parents told me that atheism was correct, but because it was kind of a rebellious to the environment that I grew up in. And, you know, people are kind of, you know, fairly superstitiously religious here. I'm Romanian and I grew up here. And I always kind of, you know, I like poking holes in things. So, you know, atheism was almost like an instantaneous reaction to, you know, everything that I grew up in. And I think I was 11 or 12 when I had completely figured out that atheism was correct. Because, you know, just by kind of by virtue of how illogical everything seemed around me, like, you know, what these other people believed, and, you know, kind of measuring, okay, how intellectually credible are these people? How, you know, what do they, their claims look like? I also had kind of a bit of a kind of a feminist reason to reject it, because I remember my best friend growing up, she was very religious. She was Baptist, not in the, I don't think it's exactly as in, you know, Southern Baptist, but there's a certain flavor of it here. She was very much telling me about kind of the rank order of the sexes and how we relate to God. And I just felt this, I don't know if I can accept this. You know, it's like, you know, you're the handmaiden, you're this. And I'm like, I don't know. Was there some sort of agreement to this?
Do I want to be the handmaiden? I get that.
Yeah. So I was, you know, so for me, kind of going back to religion, I saw it as, you know, I saw the utility in it. Like you said, you know, it performs functions that were sorely missing in my life, that I couldn't, you know, create alone, that were coordination problems that, you know, needed to, you know, the participation of other people. So you kind of had this whole meta coordination framework that religion provided, and me opting out of it just, you know, so willy-nilly, then I kind of thought, you know, maybe I made a mistake. And now but it is, you know, the difference between you know, believing and believing because it's useful, or trying to believe because it's useful, is really big. Is really big. And you know, it's a struggle. So I don't know. I think you highlighted, I think, in some of your writing that there are things that you believe are very worthwhile in Mormonism, and that you've missed them since you kind of parted ways with the faith. I mean, what things do you think are kind of essential and a bit harder to get outside of a faith tradition or maybe outside of Mormonism?
Absolutely. I think the essence of any religion, what you were talking about in terms of things you can't do on your own, there is something extraordinarily valuable and extraordinarily meaningful about having a physical community that you can go to and know that you are among your tribe. And you can go anywhere in the world and know that you are among your tribe as a Mormon. You can travel to wherever, find church on Sunday, step in, and feel like, usually even with the exact same lessons that you would be having in your church at home, there's like a series of lessons in Sunday school that all of them go through the same time, same year. So you go to a different one and you sit down and you're like, I would have been hearing basically the same thing at home. Or, oh yeah, these guys are a week behind. I heard this one last week. So there's that charming sense of just the hominess to familiarity, but not just hominess and familiarity, of knowing that you are intellectually aligned, in a sense. Not that everyone has the same intellectual approach to it, but that you can basically know that everyone sort of feels the same way about this or that or the other, and you can have that confidence in community with that. I think there is a strength to that. There's a value to that, that you can't. So when people say, you know, just replace it with a board game group or whatever, just replace it with whatever social club, bowling, it's not the same and it won't be the same. And it's facile, really, to act like it could be the same. So there's that. In Mormonism in specific, there's also, on top of that, a great deal of voluntary organization that I really admire and that I find incredibly impressive. I think Mitt Romney is a great example of this. You look at Mitt Romney, who wasn't Mormon, and he would have spent all of his time, presumably, on these very, very profit-focused endeavors, or if he had a hobby, something very flashy, something very, the sort of things rich business executives do. As a Mormon, he spent years and years spending 20 hours a week, or however much time, in a very high-level volunteer position where he was the person responsible for the organization and the maintenance of. So you have a bishop who leads a local ward, a local congregation, and then a stake president who leads a region of bishops, six or seven, up to 12, I think. Anyway, and he was a stake president for a while, which you don't pick. It's not like you say, oh, I want to be a bishop. I want to be a stake president. Let's make this happen. Someone notices you and they say, you're going to be this now. Do you accept? And suddenly you have to say, basically, yeah, I accept that I'm going to spend the next 8 years volunteering a great chunk of my time for all of this. And you have that at every level. That's not just leadership positions. It's, I was the organist the pianist for a lot of my congregations, where I just every Sunday go in and I sit up there and I play the songs, and you know, I'd be playing the hymns and singing them, and I love the hymns, I do. And other people, you know, they teach Sunday school every week. People are assigned to give talks, so forth, to go up and just say their thoughts on things. And there's something cool about being raised in a tradition with extemporaneous speaking from a very young age. A lot of these things, a lot of these volunteer positions and a lot of this structure that you just don't get in other organizations the same way. Structure that I would say completely disconnected on the individual level from the standard financial concerns that most structures end up getting enmeshed with, just because finances, they're part of it, but they don't really enter into the physical picture for most people most of the time. And that's a very different environment to, say, a startup or other places with intensely organized culture. A lot of that. Also, the doctrine, within the doctrine, I really deeply appreciate the image within Mormonism of life as one step in this eternal process towards becoming perfect, in this process towards recognizing what is bad, recognizing what is good, pursuing the good, and continually reaching higher, and knowing that it's impossible, but wanting to reach higher. Obviously, Christianity, which Mormons consider themselves, and I consider them a subset of, recognizes this, A, this pursuit of perfection on the one hand, B, its impossibility on the other. And they square that circle by saying, Christ came, Christ died for everyone, therefore you can do all of this. That part, obviously, I don't accept anymore. So what I'm left with is the same instinct of life as a pursuit of perfection and life as this impossible, doomed struggle towards the beautiful and the good, but without the same, everything has been handled in a sense, and just make it to the end and you will see this beautiful perfection made manifest. So what I'm left with is sort of this quest for salvation without the confidence that salvation exists.
Yes. I mean, there's been quite a recent surge in interest and in kind of more traditional beliefs. I mean, what do you make of, you know, people kind of trying to go back to something? And in many ways, it's, you know, it's kind of the trad movement, but it's kind of an umbrella term, which is just kind of people reaching the end of history, flailing around a little bit, and then, you know, trying to retreat a few steps and saying, okay, we have to hook back into tradition. And then when they try to do that, you know, they're some pick, you know, Orthodox Christianity, you know, a quite foreign and exotic faith, because it is foreign and exotic. Or, you know, they plug back into Catholicism or, you know, evangelicals or something like that. I mean, what have you made of this trend? I mean, as someone who's kind of stepped away from, I guess, fairly traditional environment, whatever, you know, even though Mormonism is quite recent in terms of long history, it's quite a traditional community. I mean, what do you think of the trad movement?
I have deep running sympathies for it, that I try to be pretty apparent about in my writing and in my public presentation. And of course, a lot of my fellow liberals are warier of it and think that all these people are completely barking up the wrong tree and just acting insane. I don't think they're acting insane. I think they are noting a real lack, and I think they are looking for the things that they have seen others say fills that void, and really trying very seriously to wrestle with some of the really serious cultural and emotional problems that we face in our day. What I don't think, I do not think that it is a successful meta path. That is, I think a few people can take this trad path, take this intellectual trad path, say, I have been missing something and I may not precisely believe, but I see the value of this thing and I want to intellectually operate within this sphere. That's, as you were sort of noting, it's a very different experience to want to believe and to believe. It's a very different experience to be Orthodox and to be orthoprax, but not Orthodox. And it's a very difficult thing to convince your mind of something in the way that the people who are really deeply within these really convince themselves of. And I think it's a mistake to really try to convince your mind of a lot of these things, because fundamentally, the way I see these, and of course it's the way I see them, and people who are very sincerely religious will strongly disagree, but the way I see them is, you look at Christianity, and it was the latest stable iteration of folk religion in the Near East that was very precisely adapted to the needs of that time and has hit on enough more universal truths and hit on a stable enough iteration that it was able to entrench itself and spread much further. And I think, you know, that means that there is something useful there. You don't reach that level of success without there being something useful there. But I don't think people feeling that same yearning today, I don't think returning to Christianity is the answer. I think what is needed, and this, of course, this ends up tying into my own project, but I think what is needed is something that is genuinely responsive to the culture and the needs of today in a way that traditionalism itself, by definition, cannot be. I think that what is needed is the much, much, much more difficult path of building something new, something that is at once new and respectful of the old and aware of the old, aware of what has been built, why it has been built, and but not strictly constrained by what has been built, such that it cannot make space for and cannot understand the unique issues and the unique situations that we find ourselves in this present day.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was speaking to Malcolm and Simone Collins, and not sure if you're aware of them, kind of the designer baby couple.
Yeah, I went on their podcast a week ago, yeah. Actually.
Yeah, they're wonderful, and they've essentially kind of have this system of building their own religion, and they have kind of this concept of descendant worship, and I think it's very interesting. Obviously, they're quite a quirky couple, and their intellectual output is matches their vibes, but the only thing that I because obviously I think this is very it's kind of compelling to me at first sight, but the thing that I think is missing compared to more traditional religion, if you do, go the Orthodox route, is the metaphysical buy-in. I don't think any sort of materialism plus type of religion, however interesting the philosophy is behind it, it just doesn't have the same amount of weight as I am, subsumed by the immensity of creation, and the creator has, I have a personal relationship to the deity that's created everything. I feel, and without that commitment, I think the whole superstructure that this, future religion or religion needs, falls flat. You can't have the coordinating function if you don't have the weight. Because that's why we're here. That's why we go every Sunday. That's why, maybe there's a certain, inertia or like a momentum to it where the community itself becomes it. But to actually go and do and be and, present yourself to the community and go there enough to make the community worth it. I feel like, that's kind of that little step that I don't know, because I remember I was in London in my atheist years, just about 10 years ago, and I would go to a thing called Sunday Assembly, which was kind of this attempt at building community and having kind of this almost like happy clappy evangelical style kind of sermon for atheists and people who are agnostics or just not related to religion. I went about 3 or 4 times, and then I used my Sunday for something else. Maybe other people were more committed, but it just feels like, without that, without the thing, it's entertaining, but it's not, it wasn't heavy enough for me. You know what I mean?
Oh, I absolutely know that. And I think you are absolutely correct almost about it. What I will say, though, and this is the greatest challenge, this is the core challenge of a secular religion, is achieving something that fits that. What I will say is that it has been achieved in secular religions. I don't know that it has been achieved in a healthy way in secular religions, but it has absolutely been achieved in secular religions. I would point to Orthodox Marxism from the 19th century onward that managed to get such a strong core group of true believers that they had enough conviction to overthrow nations. They had enough conviction to threaten the foundations of the order the world is built on. And I do not think that conviction was healthy. I do not think that framework was healthy. And I think very few in your audience would say that that framework was healthy. But I do think that framework was real, was motivating, and was compelling to an extent that absolutely matches the vitality of any religion you care to look at. I think more recently, there are two groups that I would point to. One that I consider broadly healthy, but a little bit misguided, and one that I know your audience very much considers unhealthy, but that I think needs to be approached on its own terms. And the first of those, the healthy one, is effective altruism. I love the effective altruists. Every effective altruist I've met is earnestly, very deeply committed to the idea of doing good and wants to understand how to and wants to be effective at it, wants to really sincerely wants to pursue the good. And they have developed a framework around utilitarianism that is, it contains the same compelling force. Now, ultimately, I think that they go a little off the rails in this sort of location agnostic utilitarianism, in that I think that people do have greater duty to those near them in whatever sense you want to use near. Parents have greater duty to their children. People have greater duty to their communities than to distant places. People have greater duty to the subcultures that they resonate with than the subcultures that are alien to them. And I don't think effective altruists, on a fundamental level, I don't think effective altruism is equipped to wrestle with that. But within the framework that they have, they do a lot of really cool things and sometimes some very much mistaken things, but sincere and aimed towards the good. Then there's also social justice progressivism, which I think is the first experience that many, many, many people have with a truly vital religion. Because separation of church and state, that's not the natural state of a religion. Separation of religion and science, that is not the natural state of a religion. These things are things that have been fought for, that have been forged in blood. And these are things that we take for granted in modern culture. But these are not the natural states of a religion. These are the states of a tame religion. These are the states of a religion that has realized that there are forces as powerful as itself that it must make concessions to, at least as powerful as itself that it must make concessions to. You know, the Peace of Westphalia, way back when, was one of those major concessions where these religions realized we can't just fight this out forever. Like, we need to find some way to coexist here, despite having fundamentally incompatible frames. And as soon as you have to do that, and as soon as you recognize that, I think it's a healthier frame, but it weakens it in a sense. It reduces its vitality in a sense. And people in those religions sense this. Some of these trad guys sense this. Some of these Catholic integralists who want to return to the days without separation of church and state really sense this and really resent it. But that's the religion they live in. This whole separation of church and science, I mean, I'm not going to present any sort of this caricature of this. You know, Catholics were some of the leading proponents of science for a long while and some of the leading advancers of it for a long while. But there were these tension points. There were these points where they expected one thing to be true. They found another thing was true. And it led to schisms. It led to splits. And ultimately, it led to what still remains this very fundamental tension, not necessarily irresolvable for individuals' tension, but absolutely a tension between evolution, between old earth, between all of these newfangled science ideas with the traditional religious conceptions. And Christianity has been living within those tensions. Social justice progressivism, people see it intruding on science magazines. People see it intruding on universities, intruding on all these areas that we have set aside for the pursuit of knowledge. And of course it's intruding on them, because that's what a religion does, because that's what you do when you believe in something. And so on and so forth. You look at it, a lot of people, this whole social justice progressivism is a religion idea. It's not new. It's not unique to me. But what I would say is a lot of the people who talk about it are very much in the new atheist mold of it is a religion and that is bad. My argument would be it is a religion and that is the most interesting thing about it. But it has very much that vital force that propels people to do things. It has the force that makes people organize, that makes people go out and make all these protests, that makes people go out and find like-minded people and associate with like-minded people and shun non-believers. It has all these sorts of things that you can very much associate with hallmarks of a really serious, young, fledgling religion still finding its feet. And so my question isn't, can a secular religion be built? It is, the current leading most vital religion attuned to the needs of the age is one that I consider pretty unhealthy, and I am confident your audience considers very unhealthy. And so the question is, can something better be built?
Mm. Yeah. I wonder, because I think at the core of kind of social progressivism is the idea that it is secular. I wonder if there is a way to build a counterforce that doesn't have to be, non-secular. So essentially, like, it's kind of the natural enemy of this vital religion would have to be something that is religious at its core. I think it's an interesting thought experiment. I think it kind of ties into one of the things that you've written on about the doomed Republican Party. It doesn't really have a vital religion at its core, does it?
No, it doesn't. And anyone who notices the right-wing ecosystem online in particular knows this, because nobody in the online right ecosystem is this traditional conservative who is deeply committed to the principles of, frick, I don't know, Reagan. You don't have, like, a lot of them like Reagan, but the Republican establishment completely lost its credibility with all these right-wing figures. And so you look at the ones who are really committed to ideas, really playing with things. And I think a lot of them are playing with some very dangerous and very ugly things, personally. But none of them really like the Republican Party. So all of these vital forces, all of these interesting forces, all of these, like, serious forces, they see the Republican Party as a necessary evil, a tool, a means to an end. But they're not serious about the Republican Party for its own sake, for its own values. And this has been the reality of the Republican base, the Republican Party as a whole, is that it has been overtaken by this populist right impulse that is really unaligned with its structure. So, there's that in it. And there's more broadly the reality that this populist structure is not an elite structure, and it's not meant to be an elite structure. It's a structure that appeals to it's populist. It appeals to the people. And when I say the people, I mean a specific subset of often older or more rural or less educated people. Which, look, I'm not going to badmouth those groups. But they are not the sort of people who go out and hold prestigious, low-paying positions in institutions that work with ideas. They just aren't. And if you want any idea-centered movement, you need a lot of people who really believe in your vision, who will enter those institutions. So what we see based on this increasing age and education polarization between the parties, and this is the thesis of my Republican Party is doomed point, is that the Republicans, the strategy that they have pursued has kept them a class of intellectuals who tolerate them but are intolerable to the mainstream because of one or another I would agree with the mainstream, one or another really ugly, intolerable ideas, but interesting. And then you have a base of people who know exactly what they want someone to do, but they just can't find anyone in any institution to do it. And I think that is the demographic reality that the Republican Party will face for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and what is interesting to me, and what was interesting to me, and continues to be interesting to me about the online right, is that this is kind of a fledgling contingent of relatively elite people, many of them. I think the energies in this space have led to a lot of schisms, a lot of infighting, which has kind of fragmented the potential pool of actual people who could, build this so-called counter-elite. And I feel because of these schisms, they've been cleaving off potential, you know, fragments of the elite because of, you know, there's just a certain dynamics on these platforms. Because on the one hand, you have this idea of a movement, you know, you want, you know, we want the future to be more right wing, you want it to be ordered, you want it to be hierarchical, you want, you know, kind of the core principles of the right to be successful, you know, politically in the future and implement your vision of that, you know, limit immigration, all of that. The problem that you have on the online right is that this is online. You know, the way you create a name for yourself is by continuously beefing with other people. You want to cleave off audience from other online right influencers by, you know, having your niche thing. A lot of times the niche thing means that you are pretty heavy-handed with, you know, cleaving off parts of the audience that, you know, don't belong to your core audience, which is typically like young white males. You know, if they're women, they can go kick rocks. If they're Jews, oh yes, please, please leave. I think, you know, the, you know, whatever one thinks about the Jews, you know, they're definitely not non-elite. And if you really want to get rid of them, that's fine. I understand women are not always, you know, the best ingredients for your soup, but, you know, there's all sorts of subgroups, you know, high caste Indians also, we don't like them. So, you know, cleave and cleave and cleave and cleave. And then I'm sure the rarefied elite that, that is left there, you know, is quite elite, but it's very small. It's going to be tough to conquer with, you know, your band of brothers of, you know, the 15 people left in your group chat. So, you know, I think just the dynamics of the whole thing are counterproductive in this sense.
There's that, but I would say it even goes more fundamental to that. And even to the very name of this podcast and the very name of the dissident right in general, is that when you're talking about these traditional right-wing values, you know, this order, this structure, this hierarchy, so forth, currently the right wing doesn't have a concrete order, structure, hierarchy that is coherent. They are not the institutional ones in charge. So what you see in the United States is a grand inversion of culture, where the current tradition of the United States is questioning the tradition of the United States. The current hierarchy within the United States is you rise in it by questioning the hierarchy of the United States. The current culture, the current cultural force, the current dominant cultural force is questioning, is to question the current dominant cultural force. And so you go to a Museum of American History in the heart of, you know, Washington, D.C., the capital of America, and you look around and everything in it will be questioning its own history, because that is the dominant force. And as a result of this same great inversion, the people who want to say, yeah, I support elites and I support tradition and I support hierarchy, will say, but I'm a bold, edgy dissident, but I am subversive, but I am all of these things that are really not associated with those structures and those values. And what this creates is an incredible tension within it, where you see people who, on the one hand, want to say all these high-minded things, want to say all these elite things, but on the other hand, really want to and really relish wallowing in the mud. And anyone who has spent any time around the dissident right knows just how much wallowing in the mud there is, where people will just, as you're talking about, like trying, it's part of this carving all these groups away and making sure these people know they don't belong and making sure those people know they don't belong and making sure we maintain our pure vault, what have you, whatever. A lot of that comes with just really, really ugly mimetic forces, both, I mean, both physically ugly ideas, where you have people like, say, I think soyjack.party or /Paul, you go there and you cannot help but be viscerally repulsed by the aesthetics they surround themselves with. They wallow in the low aesthetically. They wallow in the ugly. They wallow in the viscerally gross aesthetically, because they're trying to shock people, because they're trying to push people away. And, you know, there's that. But then there's also, on a deeper level, things that are just really atrocious idea-wise. You know, you have people who will cleave themselves to whatever failed, bitter, ugly ideas of the past. They're like, you know, at least this is a hierarchy. At least this is order. Let me figure out how I can defend Hitler again. Let me figure out how I can defend the Confederacy. Let me figure out how I can defend things that anyone in my actual tradition, anyone in the actual religious traditions that these people are valorizing, has looked at those things and concluded at the time and concludes in the present that those things were ugly and that those things were bad and those things were worth pushing against. People in their actual tradition that they would celebrate, that they would say they celebrate, have always known precisely what to think of those things. But in this weird online ecosystem with all the incentives you're talking about, suddenly it becomes cool to figure out, how can I really prove my right-wing bona fides by showing just how vigorously I can defend some of these great evils of history? And I think that's what the online right ecosystem really struggles with.
Yeah, and I think it is a bit of a struggle, because I think a lot of people, you know, myself included, kind of, you know, after a while you look at the cycle and, you know, the cycle stares back and you see that, you know, what how it works, you know, how what the mechanics of it is. And you see that, you know, I recently had a bit of a kind of a, you know, like a come to Jesus moment, where I was just kind of told people that, okay, you know, the woman hate is getting a bit tough here. It's a bit tough. And people were like, there is no movement. What are you talking about? You know,
how just, dare you? You know, how dare you notice that?
How dare you? Exactly. So, yeah, I think it's, in a way, yes, this is all super decentralized, you know, but any sort of aspirations that anyone who's serious about either politics, about philosophy or anything in these spaces and really values the truth, at one point you kind of have to say, okay, you know, there's a certain, you know, sanitization. I know this is a place that has to be funny, but, you know, it really isn't funny anymore. Even, you know, the kind of high-minded, you know, we're very tolerant here, but you know, you can have a little bit of splatter of nefarious substances in, you know, in an open. But if the idea is that to be participating in the space, everyone needs to be neck deep in the sewer. And this is, you know, and if you don't like it, you can leave. People will leave.
Yeah, people will.
People are leaving. And it is what it is. I mean, you know, I like these spaces. You know, I've spent quite a lot of time in it. You know, I have friends, quite a lot of them, who come from these spaces and are very smart and very thoughtful about a lot of these ideas. Some of them, you know, quite extreme, but, you know, I think it's very worthwhile to think about them. But it's just the wider space, Twitter especially, it's just, yeah, logging in just feels like, you know, stepping into the ditch. It's it's not fun.
No.
Sorry to say.
And I think, so this is, obviously, anyone who listens to me and anyone who seriously hears what I have to say will recognize pretty quickly that my sympathies with traditionalism are serious, that my sympathies with a lot of these ideas traditionally associated with the right are pretty serious. But my entire separation from it, like, I don't play any sort of coy, you know, oh, I'm a centrist, whatever, and, well, really being deeply, very fundamentally right-wing. I don't really do that, and I don't try to be like, you know, I'm a liberal, I'm definitely a liberal, but I'm always trying to push all these right-wing ideas on you, whatever. I, you know, if the left listens to me, they listen. If they don't, great. But what I would say is, in terms of wanting to build a place that I seriously want to spend time, wanting to build a place with, you know, people pursuing beauty and people pursuing excellence and people pursuing vitality and people welcoming anyone who feels the same pull towards those and feels the same pull towards these really compelling concepts, I think the only place that can be built right now is the center. And I think that there's not nearly as much organization in the center as there is even in the online dissident right now. I would say, in as much as there is a centrist movement, the thing about centrists is that centrists are sort of, the default centrist is anti-movement. I am a very uncommon centrist in the sense of the most politically involved people are usually left and are usually right. You don't see a lot of like really passionate, really politically involved, really very serious centrists. And so, but very many people who have better things to do are temperamentally centrist. So whenever, you know, someone who is both temperamentally centrist and politically active speaks up, suddenly a lot of these people who would never organize, would never take a lot of serious political action, say, yeah, I kind of like what that guy's saying. People, you know, a lot of these disengaged people instinctively like centrists, but you don't have a lot of organization there. So what I would say, in as much as I see an intellectually exciting fledgling movement, it's not precisely defined yet, because this is my frustration with it. Anyone in my tribe resents the idea of tribes altogether and is very convinced that they're an independent free thinker who doesn't need any tribe. And so you have a lot of really interesting and a lot of really thoughtful people who, even more than the right wing, it's like herding cats with the online center, because they'll call themselves heterodox and they'll call themselves gray tribe, quote unquote, and they'll call themselves this or that. They'll call themselves anything but a tribe. And they very clearly have tribal impulses. You look at the ideas in there, and it very clearly there's a degree of group thought there and a degree of cohesion there. And I don't hate tribalism. I think tribalism is useful, but they hate tribalism. And so you have a center that's very much torn against itself, where at the one time it's saying, oh yeah, we're all heterodox free thinkers. But yeah, we do all sort of really care about these same issues and really want to talk about these same issues and really want to start a movement of people who think the same ways about these same things. But, you know, we're all heterodox here. We're all independent thinkers here. There's a tension there. But ultimately, I think as I'm looking at these movements, within that space, I find it most likely that the sort of thing that I'm interested in will arise. And the big part of it is that when you're talking about, you know, being a movement or being a woman in the dissident right, you know, as a gay dude, I don't even need to say how a lot of people in those spaces instinctively would react to me, you know, especially a gay dude who wants to become a father via surrogacy. That's the sort of thing that immediately makes me persona non grata in a lot of those spaces. And as soon as you are one of those people who could potentially become persona non grata in those spaces, you realize precisely how unpleasant it is to be in that spot, and you just have no interest in it. So I think that the trick that I see is basically finding a way to orient around specific values in a way that says, if someone feels this pull, they are welcome. If someone has the same sense of this sort of thing is right, this sort of thing is good, this sort of thing, like there is an excellent to pursue and it must be pursued, they are welcome. And ultimately, the right wing is so much a movement of exclusion, and the people who are most right wing are always going to be the most exclusive in one way or another. And in general, that will mean a lot of ethno-nationalism, that will mean a lot of other very ugly ideas. Ultimately, if you want an idea, something that is centered around this more inclusive pursuit of excellence, I think the only way that can really happen is in the center.
Yeah, I think the inherent challenge of centrism is that, you know, it has to be a patchwork, because there's kind of the centrist mind where it's like, I'm just in the middle of everything. That's not actually a centrist. That's just someone who defaulted to a position on the spectrum and says, okay, the middle is usually right because the truth is somewhere in between the two poles. That's typically what happens. Sometimes it's what happens, but most of the time, certain positions make more sense, and some of them will be more, you know, oriented towards, you know, classical right-wing ideas, and some of them, you know, might be worthwhile left-wing, you know, some, like, for example, you know, the European Union. I have this a lot. It's a strange tension that, you know, for Romania, it's been an absolute boon. It's been very good to be part of the European Union. For the UK, not necessarily. I'm not sure that, you know, it was, you know, the best thing to do within the context of UK and what it could be as an independent nation. That's still, you know, there's a question about it, but, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, things can be good or bad, depending on the context that, you know, they're applied in, and, you know, what subgroup they are applied to, and all sorts of things like this. And, you know, that's why I think it's probably that's essentially the challenge with, you know, with the herding cats aspect of centrism, because, you know, to be a centrist in the right way, you really might not have much in common with a lot of people, given the specific patchwork of approaches that you like.
Yeah. What I will say, and this is one of my own esoteric pursuits, is pointing out that when centrist leaders really manage to lead effectively, it turns out that the online right really likes them. So you hear on the online right a lot of adulation of Lee Kuan Yew as this really incredible leader. And they are completely right on that. What they are wrong about is the idea that Lee Kuan Yew was a right-wing leader. If you look at what he actually did and what he actually said, so first of all, the guy grew up as a labor union lawyer. He was a socialist to start out with, and he was a very serious socialist to start out with. And what happened in his evolution is he looked around and basically, starting out socialist, said, okay, we believe in fairness for all. And then he looked around and he said, okay, but human capacities are unequal and, you know, some will be able to do more, some will be able to do less. And you can only have a productive economy by allowing a degree of inequality and a degree of competition and so forth. And then he said, you know, but if that becomes too much, then there becomes all sorts of tension and resentment. And the difficulty is to strike the right balance. And he was very explicit about talking about that and experimenting with it. And in terms of economics, very much trying to find a balance between what were at the core socialist impulses, with a recognition and a very serious, honest recognition of the various differences in capacity that individuals have and the, you know, things that are needed for a world. And then politically in general, he struck out an explicit path trying to leave opposition for only the very far left and only the very far right. He very explicitly politically tried to land in the center of Singaporean politics and to define a mainstream stance. If you look at individual political things he did, you look at, say, they implemented their own version of universal healthcare. They implemented a very effective sort of welfare system and a very much less left-wing welfare system than any doctrine or left-leaning person would come up with, but it wasn't a fundamentally deeply right-wing stance. Or you look at his position on integration, on racial integration, things like that, and you see, I mean, things that right-wing people would very much loathe, like race quotas in apartment buildings in order to maintain ethnic harmony in this multi-ethnic and committedly multi-ethnic nation that he led. A lot of things like that. I'm going on a lot of specific tangents there just to highlight that the right wing really, really idolizes him as a leader. And they idolize him correctly because he was a very, very effective leader. But when I say centrism and when I say things like that, I would say both that, yes, there is a coherent sense in which it is saying there are middle ground positions that are correct. And then, as you're saying, there also is a patchwork element of you never quite know where a centrist is going to fall on any one policy until you prod at them, because a lot of it is this syncretic, pulling out one idea here, pulling out one idea there, and saying, this seems like something that can be worked with. And that does make it hard to unify people in a general sense. But as with any political wing, like, all the specific positions, like someone can take any number of specific positions. If they have the right vibes, then everyone will just go with them anyway. On the right wing, Trump's not particularly right wing in certain ways. The pro-life wing of the party hates him in some ways and everything, but he has the right vibes, so the right goes with him. I think the center can do the same thing.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting with Lee Kuan Yew especially to see what I believe appeals to the right wing in Lee Kuan Yew. It's not necessarily that, you know, he's like an ethno-nationalist or something, but that he's consciously racially aware and brings that into his policy. Like you said, you know, there are race quotas for apartment building to maintain ethnic harmony. I think what a lot of the right wing bristles against is this idea of, you know, blank slate universalism. It doesn't really matter who's where and, you know, just open the borders, you know, kumbaya, everything's fine. And I think it's not, you know, a lot of people think, okay, you know, the hard right is, you know, specifically ethno-nationalism. I think a lot of them are quite thoughtfully just racially aware, okay, what makes sense. And I think complement that with Lee Kuan Yew's quite strict law and order regime, which I think is the second layer of what the right wing really likes about him and his policies. I think that's, you know, if something like that were implemented in the West somewhere, I think a lot of right wingers, you know, even the far right people would be, especially with, you know, magical Lee Kuan Yew vibes of, you know, father of the nation types. Absolutely. People would, you know, fall over themselves to worship him. But I think that's kind of, and I think that's at the core of a lot of the vibe that the right wing is fighting against. You know, they don't like the idea of, you know, wishy-washy universalism, because it really it undermines a certain demographics, obviously, because, you know, the ones that don't profit from it, the ones that are seen, you know, like Appalachian whites, you know, profiting of white privilege. You know, we know the spiel. It's absolutely absurd. But, you know, that's, you know, just bringing in a certain awareness of this stuff, I think pretty much enough for a lot of them.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. And ultimately, I think this is why, even though I am much authentically not on the right, and authentically recognized as such by the right-wing people who listen to me, they still, a lot of, here's how I'd describe it. The lowest and the most boring, the dumb rabble of the online right sees me and they shout at me and they say, whatever you, gay furry, whatever, all this nonsense, blah, blah, blah. And they just like yell at me for a while and then go on their way. And then all their favorite thinkers follow me on Twitter. And the reason is because I take these ideas seriously and I engage with these ideas seriously. And I think that in terms of my upbringing within Mormonism, I have both an understanding from the inside and a love from the inside of what some of these like high order traditionalist communities can be. But I also know where they can go wrong and why they can go wrong and where and when they fail specific people. And I myself am one of those, you know, high openness, low conscientiousness, temperamentally left-wing people who a lot of these systems don't precisely work for. And so I can recognize it and engage with it in a way that I hope a lot of times feels serious and feels respectful and feels honest with it, while at the same time knowing precisely why I don't fit within it.
Yeah. I think, you know, it would be not a good thing for me not to address you know, the subject of surrogacy. Yeah. I think, as you mentioned, this is something that's been very much on the mind of a lot of people, especially on the right wing, because you know, this is new technology, transhumanism. There's a lot of implications, obviously, for, you know, having a market in a way in human beings. I'm personally, my stance is that I'm not necessarily for it.
No, absolutely.
I'm open to the idea in some circumstances, but you know, complete liberalization of the market for babies is quite, I don't know. It's just. It has bad vibes, man.
No,
that's all I could say. Yeah,
yeah.
I wonder what your thought process is behind it. I mean, obviously, you know, you're a gay man. You're married as well to another man. Not many avenues to having your own children except for this, I can imagine. Yeah, I mean, I can see it from that perspective as well. I don't know exactly what I would do if I was in that situation. I'm, you know, my life is different. I'm married to a man and we have children biologically. You know, I can't really imagine my life without my children. So I can see, you know, that this could be an aspiration for people for whom it's not as easy as for me. So, you know, I have empathy in that direction. But yeah, I wonder what your thought process was and kind of deciding to go for it.
Absolutely. It's an important question. I'm glad you brought it up because I know that it is a point of tension there. And it's something that I do, you know, it's complicated because I do, A, want to respect the tension, and B, want to be very clear of, you know, I'm not interested in people who I'm not interested in appealing to people who will see me as nothing but a monster, no matter what I say. I'm simply not interested in kowtowing to or like begging for them to see me as something acceptable to them. But I think there are a lot of people who do have serious concerns and who are respectful about them and who are serious and thoughtful about them. And I think it is important to talk about that stuff. For me, my interest in it comes down very fundamentally to a deeply, what I would describe as a deeply pro-life impulse, in the sense of I look around and I am very convinced that life is good, life is worth living, that it is worth bringing children into the world, and there is value and there is beauty in that, that life, there are plenty of imperfections, there are plenty of flaws, there are plenty of points of failure, there are plenty of things to complain about and things worth disliking. But the struggle against all of those things that we're all going through is meaningful. It is worthwhile and it is worth continuing. So very fundamentally, I think that the human project is a valuable one, is one worth taking seriously, worth continuing. And I think that individually becoming a parent is one of the most important things that any person can do. In terms of my own life, growing up, I didn't think of myself as gay. It was only after I left Mormonism that I noticed an interest in men. But I had never, I wondered if I would fall in love with anyone. I didn't know whether I had the capacity to fall in love with anyone for most of my life. And so I knew that I wanted kids. I knew that I wanted to be a parent. I didn't know how the specific dynamics would look. When I started seriously dating men, I looked very consciously for someone who I thought would be a good father. I looked very consciously for someone who I thought would, A, be willing to have kids, B, be capable of raising kids well, and C, be in a position in other ways where it would become a possibility. And I saved most of my own income for years just to make sure that, you know, I could A, become a father, and B, give kids a worthwhile life. So what I would say with surrogacy specifically, a lot of people will make libertarian defenses of it. A lot of people will say, you know, it's people's bodies, let them do what they want, let them, you know, what does it matter to you what other people do with their bodies? You know, I respect that. I appreciate people willing to defend my things on libertarian grounds. I'm not going to spit in the faces of libertarians. I'm also not a libertarian. I hold very clearly defined positive values. I see a lot of purpose in order, a lot of purpose in structure. And what I would defend it as is a reflection of some of those positive values. That, yes, I do think it is important that in terms of dynamics, you know, it is A, possible, and B, important to work with people who are authentically on reasonably equal grounds with you in terms of like bargaining power, what have you, to find people in terms of surrogacy who are A, who are conscious, serious adults in reasonably comfortable positions, who are not in any sort of position of desperation, and who also feel the feel that same pull that that life is A, worth continuing, and B, altruistic enough that they are seriously interested in enabling that for others. And those people do exist. Those people absolutely do exist. They're not necessarily all that common, but I don't think they're nearly as rare as other people would credit. I think there's that. I think in general, it's the sort of thing that needs to be approached with intentionality. I think everything needs to be approached with intentionality, but it's something as soon as you're deviating from the standard path, you need to be very serious and you need to be very intentional about it. You need to be aware that there is a reason the standard path exists and that there is a reason why people are wary of deviations. And it's really up to people who do depart from the standard path to demonstrate that those departures can be stable and can be worthwhile and can be meaningful iterations to that. So as I'm trying to synthesize all of this and trying to bring all this together, what it comes down to me, and the reason I'm pursuing surrogacy, is that I'm very, very convinced that life is good, that parenting is good, that it is all worth continuing, and that it is possible for people outside of the standard, you know, man-woman configuration, which, to be clear, I think that the standard man-woman configuration makes perfect sense for the great majority of people and is something that is vital and meaningful and a core part of humanity. Like, that's vital. But people who are outside of that, I think there is still space for them to live in ways that reflect deep instinctual value for the idea of parenting, raising another generation, and doing whatever it takes, A, to have kids, and B, to raise them well. And that's the role that it plays in my life.
Yes, I think, you know, I can see where you're coming from. And I think one of the worries on the right, and one that I share as well, is that there are so many ways to defect from the kind of core functional model of living life, or at least, you know, the way it's been for you know, since inception in many ways, that, you know, people just see the core model eroding, and, you know, everyone who opt out, there's always some, you know, reason. I'm an aristocrat of the soul, I'm this and that. Obviously, in your case, there are strict biological parameters that just you can't overcome, you know, if you want to become a parent, that's clear. But, you know, I think the core of the right wing pushback to a lot of, you know, alternative lifestyles and things like that is that, you know, there's fewer and fewer of the core. And, you know, it's this fear that, okay, you know, what if this disintegrates? And you have all this, you know, these discussions about, you know, birth rates and all that. Obviously, in your case, you're, you know, contributing to the birth rate. But, you know, the decay of traditional social arrangements, you know, the idea that if the ground is pulled out from underneath us, if we all realize that we are, you know, aristocrats of the soul or whatever, and participate in alternative arrangements, what about tomorrow? You know, what's going to, you know, what type of world, what uncertain conditions will we be leaving for our descendants, you know, if we're going to have them? Maybe we're not going to have them because that's, you know, that's the new alternative lifestyle, child free. So, yeah, I mean, this is obviously a more general,
yeah,
you know, not very specific to you, but I think that's kind of at the core of a lot of right wing, you know, fears.
No, I think you're completely right with that. And I sympathize with that. I sympathize deeply with that. At the same time, I think that what is at the core of a lot of the left-wing push and a lot of the reason a lot of this stuff is happening are genuine tension points in the current traditional orders that exist. You know, and I can speak very clearly to this as someone who left Mormonism. I left Mormonism because there are fundamental flaws in the Mormon structure. There are fundamental falsehoods. There are fundamental inaccuracies in that structure. And I could have turned my brain off and just kind of pressed forward, gritted my teeth, and carried on in that structure. But it wouldn't have been pleasant, and it wouldn't have been easy. And ultimately, it wouldn't have been, I think, the path that would have led me to the most excellence. So what I would say with that is that, yes, there is the right wingers who are noticing and worried about a great unraveling. I feel that. I understand that. But the left wingers who are rebelling against these structures that they feel like there is something wrong within this structure, there is something that needs to be corrected. A lot of times, the specific things that are wrong and the specific things they're saying need to be corrected, there are some serious flaws in any traditionalist structure. The task that I see is, we have these things that we value. We have these ideas that we value. We have these structures that we value. So no, I won't take a completely libertine approach and say that every approach to life is equally worth living and every path is equally worth taking. But what I will say is that, a structure exists if people are willing to fight for it. And, ideas exist if people are willing to fight for them. And I mean, fight in a way much broader than simply the, you know, clash of swords, physical. And I would say that in as much as those things are valuable, I think that someone like me, someone in a position like me, has a duty, has a very serious duty to figure out, figure out a way to keep things from unraveling, you know, figure out ways to maintain the things that are valuable and maintain the things that are worthwhile, and to be very, very clear that some things are more valuable and some things are more worthwhile than others, and that we must pursue the good and we must create positive structures, positive restrictive structures that enable us to pursue the good.
Yes, I mean, I see that. You know, I also see why, you know, yeah, the fear will probably continue. The beatings will continue.
Oh, definitely. Improve. No, it's a tension point, and it will stay a tension point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know we're coming up on time, so I'm going to ask you the last question of the show. Do you have a subversive thinker that you would like to recommend to the audience?
Yeah, in keeping with my own theme through this, I think I want to, in a sense, subvert the idea of subversion with it and say that the thinker that I want to highlight, he's not someone you'll find writing long essays or anything, but he is Prince Vogel Fry on Twitter. At Prince Vogel on Twitter. And he is a post-rationalist thinker who I would say is one of the ones who most embodies the ideals of pursuit of beauty and pursuit of excellence and pursuit of the good in a way that is aesthetically visible in his approach in far-reaching ways. So that's what I'd highlight. Not necessarily a subversive thinker, but perhaps a superversive thinker, someone who you look at his output. And for me, at least, I look at it and I see there is a compelling thread of beauty within all of this.
Yeah, excellent. I've been following him for quite a long time. So yeah, it's a very good recommendation. Thank you so much, Trace.
Yeah, thanks.
Yes. Perfect. I will link your Substack, your Twitter, and everything else in the show notes. Is there anything else that you'd like people to check out?
I think those are the big ones. I mean, also, you know, I work as the producer for the Blocked and Reported podcast. That's always a good time if you want deep dives into all the dumbest and the weirdest internet nonsense out there. So check that out as well. But...
Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.